Welcome along. It is 4 p.m. North American Eastern Time, 5 p.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes, 5:30 p.m. in Newfoundland and Labrador, 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, 10 p.m. in Western Europe, 11 p.m. in the bazaars of Cairo, midnight in Moscow, midnight 30 all over the COVID-afflicted madrasas of Tehran. And for everybody else in Asia and the Pacific, it's Saturday morning. And we're glad to have you with us, even if it is a rather ungodly hour for our listeners in Singapore, Hong Kong, and the like. You know how this works. Mark Stein Club members from anywhere around the globe get to ask me questions. You don't have to be a club member to listen to the show, so if you have no burning desire to pose some head-scratcher to me, you can just listen and enjoy it for whatever it's worth. We're thrilled to have you with us. Let's get to the... Because I've been on radio and TV for what seems like forever, certainly since the Thanksgiving break, so I don't know that I've got any sparkling freestanding insights. I'm relying on you to provide me with something that'll spark the old brain into saying something of interest. Douglas Neviera, I hope I pronounced that correctly, rather like the French Riviera. I don't know whether he's a French Neviera, but I hope I got that right. Douglas Neviera says, Mark, where do we stand? Is there any hope that Trump retains his presidency? What will be the lasting consequences of this election? Yeah, there is hope. I'm in no doubt. And the reason I basically have drawn a line on this is that I think the election was stolen. I think it was stolen by coordinated activity between about midnight and 6 a.m. on the morning of Wednesday, November the 4th, and by things that are obviously fraudulent and by techniques that are designed to overwhelm the system and rely on improper votes getting through. So there's always a hope. And I think in any other... It's hard to do international comparisons. As you know, if you've listened or read or watched me over the decades, you'll know that's what I do, because I've had the pleasure of having a career to one degree or another in many different countries, and I like to compare them. But there's nothing to compare with this unless you're actually talking about some extremely corrupt places like Mubarak's Egypt, where no one expects the election, to be honest. And I think a little of that actually goes on here, that no one really, in the way they do in Denmark or Finland, no one here really does expect the election to be 100% honest. It's just a question of whether the percentage by which it's dishonest determines the outcome of the election, as I believe it did here. Nevertheless, there is still a hope that we could get some kind of Supreme Court ruling. I believe someone or other has just filed a sua sponte motion at the Supreme Court. I know all the legal terms because I'm always being sued, and sua sponte means something that the judge can take up off his own bat, as it were. You don't need a client withstanding. And someone's just filed a motion. And I think there is enough obvious shenanigans, to use a word I'm very wary of. What was it I said the other day? S-H-E-N-A-N-I-G-A-N spells shenanigan. Yeah, that'd be a nice, appropriately Irish hail to the chief if Joe Biden ever does walk into a room in the capacity of president. And some of what has gone on is so brazen that it might seriously attract the attention of judges. Now, the problem with this is, and I know that there's fellas like Mark Levin who go, "We're not a democracy, we're a republic," and that's all well and good. But the point here is, yes, that's true, the Constitution is designed so that it is not just pure democracy. That's correct. But the reality, and that's why the Constitution provides the check and balance by which the legislatures can remove the electors and appoint their own electors. But as a practical matter, yes, it is a democracy to the extent that you're not going to be able to find legislators or judges who are willing to overturn what is perceived to be the will of the people. So if you're going and asking for electors to be thrown out and replaced by, tell me what state legislator of all lowly positions is going to have the guts to do that, particularly at a time when 90 minutes after he does it, Antifa will be lobbing Molotov cocktails through his living room window. That ain't ever going to happen. And likewise, the slightly less implausible scenario is if judges act. And what are the judges going to do? I think it's easier to ask, I said this on Rush, and I think it's the fairest thing to ask for, to say these were dirty elections, let's have runoff elections. Different states have different timelines for runoff elections. I think in Rhode Island, they've happened at the federal level before. In Rhode Island, I believe it's 10 days, whereas in Georgia, it's 28 days. And just to go back, so it's not over till it's over. And then you say, what will be the lasting consequences of this election? And there's two possibilities for that. Either the lasting consequence is that every election is stolen and the Republicans never win again at the national level. And that's one option. Or you could go for option B, where the country determines to clean up its filthy elections, for which there is no comparison anywhere else in the free world. And defining that as broadly as one might wish. So we include much of Europe, and except Belarus, and we include obviously Australia and New Zealand and Tuvalu, and the British West Indies, and even quite a few places in Africa and Latin America these days. There's not a lot of comparison with what goes on here. And the will to clean it up, is there the will to clean it up? Because if there is not the will to clean it up, then they're never going to go back. This works fine for the Democrats. So you're going to have loosey-goosey, no corroborated signature, mail-in elections stretching over 3 months now forever. Until eventually, at one point, the count of the presidential election in its 13th month meets the early voting for the midterm election coming the other way. And they'll actually cross over. And America will have achieved the great perfection of its politics in that it will never not be election season. And if you think that's just going to be a total waste of time that prevents any useful conversation on anything, that's terrible, because it will mean we don't ever talk about anything important. So if we can't, if the judges, if the Supreme Court doesn't want to get interested in this, then the important thing is to have serious electoral reform, demand serious electoral reform, because otherwise there's no point playing this game. And my sense is that, yes, there are some angry people out there, and they're all, you know, a lot of them are berating friends of mine for being insufficiently butch, as they see it, on those things. But there is also a terrible fatalism. What has happened here is, I believe, the biggest electoral heist of the Democratic era. And the awfulness of that and the implications of that are just too profound so that in a sense, it's easier to obsess on trivia. It's easier to complain that Joe Biden's nominee for Deputy Assistant Undersecretary of the Bureau of Paperwork is a Black Lives Matter supporter. That's the least of it. But people are focusing on as you'll know if you watched mostly unwatchable crappy TV these last few weeks, people would rather focus on the least of it because the central truth is too awful to live with. if you to confront it means you have to do something about it. And to do and the options you have, the choices of what you can do about it are so awful, because this is as basic a negation of constitutional stability as anything. A national election is a fraud. If you have a fraudulent election, if you have an election where dead people, where underage people, where people who are citizens of other countries all vote, what you have there is a negation of citizenship. The right to vote and the value of your vote is the essence, is the most important essence of what it means to be a citizen. And so if you have your vote cancelled out by some guy born during the Civil War, or some guy who's actually a citizen of Honduras, or some kid who's just 15, then in fact your citizenship has been negated and people can't handle it. And particularly weedy Republicans, the kind of Republicans who depend on their entourages. And don't forget, again, we have some of the crappiest politicians on the planet. We have people who can't answer a question without staffers. We have people who are utterly dependent on their entourages. And beyond that, they're dependent on the focus groups and pollsters. And all the pollsters, you know, if you, the essence of the average house-trained Republican politician of the pre-Trump era is he's risk-averse. So they don't want him to talk about illegal immigration because it sounds like you don't like immigrants. And they're heartwarming stories. They're doing the jobs. They're putting food on their family, as George W. Bush liked to say. And so people say, don't talk about illegal immigration because all people hear is that you don't like foreigners. And don't talk about any of the LGBT QWERTY issues because people just think you're uncool with transgenders. And don't venture into education and complain about teachers' unions, because when you attack teachers' unions, people just hear you attacking teachers, and we all like teachers and blah, 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 blah. So you're talking about a body of politicians, the Republican establishment, that is institutionally risk-averse and has ceded the language to the left on this for two generations now, and is in the obvious position that results when you do that, when you play every game on the left's terms, when you argue every issue on the left's terms. And now they're faced with this. And as they see it, the minute they start to go on about questionable voting in Georgia or anywhere else, then they're accused of not wanting to, quote, count every vote, which means you don't like black people voting. You're trying to suppress the vote. You all the ways. So we have an institutionally risk-averse body, the Republican establishment, that doesn't want to do anything. And then we have 80% of Mr. Trump's voters who think this election was stolen. And one of those sides is going to win, hopefully. Or, as the Republican establishment sees it, they're going to force the 80% who think this thing's a crock to swallow it and wait until, oh, you know, this is great. But we're looking really good for 2022. And don't forget, by 2022, people may be really sick and tired of the Biden-Harris administration. So send money now. Send money now. Send money now. That's all they got to say. John Maravich writes, I hope I pronounced that correctly. I'm doing it in the Serb way, but I might be all wrong on that. Anyway, John writes, so 66,248 voted while too young to be eligible. How does that work? Who registered them? When? It sounds like Georgia is simply not capable of running an honest election in Dixville Notch Hotel. In New Hampshire. I was rather rude about the Dixville First in the Nation vote the other day. But they are capable of running a very corrupt election in Georgia. All of this has to go. The stupidity of this. And again, Republicans won't go near it because it's perceived as racist somehow to demand ID. I was talking to Ilan from South Africa on the radio for Rush the other day, and Ilan made an excellent... I thought about this call because it was for us Commonwealth chappies, it was the nearest thing to a normal call, and I'd had some back and forth with Canadians, Australians, other parts of Her Majesty's dominions after it, because Ilan had the... You know, if Ilan, and this happens because if you're a Commonwealth citizen and you happen to go to move to London or Belfast or wherever, you can vote in a UK election. If you're a Canadian, the lady at the Meridian Hotel in Piccadilly, she was a lovely young lady from Quebec, and I was checking in, and so we were making a little chit-chat, and I was saying, oh, how long are you in the UK for, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, you should vote in next month's election. She said, really? How can I do that? I'm Canadian. And I said, no, you can. You can go along and vote in a UK election. So a lot of people like Ilan, you have experience of voting in other places, and they're all the same. If a Canadian votes in a UK election, an Australian election, a New Zealander votes in a Tuvaluan election. You're all very, it's all the same. It's all very familiar. And then you come to America and you notice that at the very low level, like a New Hampshire town meeting, is more or less recognizable to you. People vote with paper ballots. And they elect their various candidates. And then you have these absolutely nutty Tuesdays in November that are just a chaotic, a stew of fraud and corruption, because that's the system the Democrats want. And no one has the urge to stand up to them. And mostly, again, as I've outlined on whatever it was, either Rush or the Mark Steyn show, I forget what, which, mostly it just makes the difference this or that congressional election, this or that Senate election, this or that gubernatorial election. Well, they've now done it with the presidency. And unless you're willing to change that, they're not going to win. Why would they want to let you win next time? You know, ask yourself how that's going to work. Kevin Clark says, assuming you're correct about the examples of election fraud, why do you think Trump's lawyers are not making the same arguments in their court filings? It seems to me either they don't believe them or they're incredibly disorganized and incompetent. It seems extremely unlikely at this point that they'll have any success with the lawsuits. You know, again, I'd go with disorganized and incompetent. You have to know that, and I say that this as a permanent civil litigant, and these are civil litigants. And a civil litigant is not like a criminal case where the court doesn't have a discretion about whether to accept it. If the state brings charges against you for breaking into a liquor store, that case is going to proceed. It's different with civil litigation. You have to persuade a judge that you've got a controversy that is appropriate for the court to adjudicate. And you're dependent on your lawyers. And America has more lawyers. It's important to remember this, because my friend Conrad Black always points it out. America has as many lawyers as the rest of the world combined, which means that just if you think of it as averaging out, it has more crap lawyers than the rest of the planet combined. But I actually think it's higher than that. Because the whole nature of the legal system here is big and bloated. I'm taking a little bit of time with this because I want to explain it, because I've had experience of this. I was in Nevada, as the president is, the president suing in Nevada. And I was having a very pleasant cup of tea with the guy who I thought was the lawyer on the Nevada case. And he said to me, oh, I'm going to be fourth chair on this case. And I remember thinking, wait a minute, fourth chair? What do you mean by that? Fourth chair? How many chairs are there? What is this? The Berlin Philharmonic? I had no idea that's actually normal for an American case. And By comparison, for example, my great comrade in our human rights battles up north, Julian Porter QC, Queen's Counsel for our American listeners, Julian was the lawyer. There were no chairs. There was only one chair and he had it. I sat on the edge of the desk because he was the lawyer. On three different human rights cases, he did them all. And so what it happens, and I've got experience of this right now, actually, in a certain aspect of the Michael Mann case, not with my lawyers, but with another party's lawyers, where they've got one of these hotshot name big lawyers, a guy called Carvin, who blew the Obamacare suit before the Supreme Court, which is why you're stuck with Obamacare, because he blew that. And there'd been other big cases he's done. So when you have four chairs, seven chairs, nine chairs on a lawsuit, what it means is that some paralegal writes the brief, and then the head guy comes in and takes credit for it when you go into court. And so what it means actually is that even if it's not all by the paralegal, it's gone through a couple of different hands and it doesn't actually read terribly coherently. And I think that's what you've got with this thing. I think there's obviously, you know, the most important thing is to simplify the tale you lay before the judge. And under the civil standard, you're not talking beyond a reasonable doubt. You're just talking about the preponderance of evidence. So you just have to basically hint at sufficient evidence to have a preponderance that will get you into the courthouse to argue the case. And so you just have to have enough of a coherent theory of the case to make it difficult for the judge to respond favorably to the opposition's motion to get it kicked out. And I think disorganized and incompetent gets to it. You know, and I say this, I read the both Sidney Powell motions, and my initial reaction, as you know, I said that the minute you start bringing Hugo Chavez and these kinds of people into it, that you're basically going to be this season's version of the Durham Report or the Steele dossier or whatever. It's just too big to expect a district judge in, you know, wherever, to feel it's something that his court can adjudicate. You've got to actually keep it simpler, and you've got to tell that. And I read that 100-page motion, and it seems to me like it's a thing that's been written by, it reads to me like a thing that's been written by too many people, and then they just merge the document and you're jumping all around. So one minute you're talking about boxes of ballots, and then the next minute you're talking about Hugo Chavez, and then the next minute, and you can't, it's not anything I would have allowed to be submitted with my name on. And as I said, this is civil litigation. This is the Trump campaign versus whoever, just as it's, you know, in the District of Columbia, it's Michael Mann versus Mark Stein. So, you know, I think that's a problem. These are not the briefs I would have filed. These are not motions I would have put my name on. And I would make a further point on that too, that I think actually the president, since I'm talking about this, you know, if the president doesn't win, there's going to be more than enough bloodletting to go around. You're going to want to stand well back, because if this other guy is sworn in on January 20th, then by January 31st, the Republican Party is going to be up to its neck in blood. I think the president actually needs to be more disciplined and focused about this. You can't just keep saying, oh, it's terrible, terrible, the whole thing was rigged. You've got to say, I've told him, Fulton County, you know, just Fulton County alone is a toilet, is a sewer. You've got to talk about things people can grasp. People can't grasp algorithms being manipulated by Hugo Chavez from beyond the grave. But they can certainly grasp an election count being shut down and the counters ordered home for a fake toilet water pipe burst that in fact does not exist, that never happened, and then suitcases of votes being moved in the middle of the night. People can understand that, and that's important too. Scott Scherzer writes, Dear Mark, in my opinion, the most glaring evidence of fraud in this presidential election is that a mummified corpse who seldom left his sarcophagus received over 81 million votes. In his two previous runs for the presidency, Joe Biden drew almost no support. In this year's first three Democrat caucuses primaries, he finished fourth, fifth, and second against a less than stellar slate of candidates. To put it bluntly, there was near zero enthusiasm for his candidacy. That's right. He didn't need COVID. If you saw him in New Hampshire, if you went to a rather oxymoronically named Joe Biden rally in New Hampshire, he was socially distant before social distancing was cool. There was no one in there. If he went to playing in a grade school gym in New Hampshire, there were like 27 people there. And now, mysteriously, 81 million turned out to vote for him. While I would like to blame the utter disaster that was this election on the Democrats in general and the left in particular, it's mostly the fault of Republicans. Five of the six states where the fraud battle is being fought have Republican majority legislatures, Nevada being the exception. Can you explain to me how lawmakers in Pennsylvania, Georgia, Arizona, Wisconsin, and Michigan permitted changes to their state election laws that allowed for millions of mail-in ballots that required little to no proof of authenticity? As usual, the Republicans have been played for saps. On a positive note, I am looking forward to the Stein Club cruise in October, assuming Admiral Fauci gives the okay, says Scott Scherzer. Yeah, you know, that's basically why they lost in Pennsylvania, because they were complaining about the system. They were complaining not about fraud, but the system under which the election was held. And the revisions to the election law, and this again shows how the Democrats were thinking ahead, they passed that, I think it was in June, in Pennsylvania, in June 2019. So in other words, at that point, the Chi-Coms were basically still mixing up the original formula for the COVID. They were still in the lab in Wuhan, heating it up over the Bunsen burner before figuring out which bat to inject it into. And yet the Democrats, they're far-sighted, the Chinese, and so are the Democrats. And so the Democrats passed this thing in June 2019 and under the, whatever they call it, the doctrine of latches. You're supposed to prosecute your case in a timely manner. So you can't wait until, you can't wait to protest the rules of the election until after you've lost the election. The Pennsylvania and the Supreme, I don't believe the Supreme Court will interfere with that, the US Supreme Court. The Pennsylvania Court basically said, look, they passed this thing in June 2019. If you were steamed about it, you should have brought a motion. It's like, it's basically like the same sort of philosophy as a statute of limitations. You can't wait. If you get held up at gunpoint while you're gassing up the car, you can't leave it 30 years to go to the cops about it. You know, and that's basically the problem that the Republicans had. Richard Kasky says, hello, Mark. Could you please speak to the advertisers of boycott currently being waged against Tucker Carlson and by extension you? It seems that without Mike Lindell, that's the My Pillow guy. We all love the My Pillow guy. God bless him. He's actually in Georgia doing his bit for Trump. Actually, just one final thought on those cases. The reason I mentioned Trump's position and Trump's argument is that Trump, through sheer force of will, can accomplish things that other people can't. And actually, he needs to be actually, if it is basically the Trump campaign versus the state of Nevada, versus the state of Georgia, versus the state of Michigan, it would actually help, I think, for the candidate actually to be there in in some of these courtrooms and to be actually more involved in figuring out a clear, coherent narrative in these motions. Like Mike Lindell, he's on the ground in Georgia. It seems that without Mike Lindell and the Medicare helpline, oh God, don't get me started, I'll take my pillow over the Medicare helpline any day. He would have no sponsors at all. Seeing ads for the Flippity Fish is a jarring example of the type of sponsor. If you don't know the Flippity Fish, that's the fish that flops around as if it's out of water, and the cat is supposed to be more interested in the Flippity Fish than most diversions because the cat thinks it's so incredibly lifelike. The cat thinks it is a real fish flopping around out of water. In my experience, the cat only buys that for about 6 or 7 minutes. Seeing ads for the Flippity Fish is a jarring example of the type of sponsors willing to underwrite the most honest opinion show on any major broadcast network. I would like to know which cowardly companies have abandoned the show and why. Maybe a Tucker Carlson Club or a Tucker Stein Cruise could be in our future. Thank you. I know one of them. What's it called? I can't remember how. Most of them bailed because of this pathetic Twitter pressure. But some of them are genuinely woke, like the T-Mobile guy. T-Mobile? Guy was boasting that he had immediately yanked his ads from Tucker and wanted nothing more to do with him. T-Mobile is that cell phone company. I really only know them. I once did business with them. I had an account with them, mainly because when I was overseas, if you were sitting in a little, you know, latte joint in northern Finland or in the outback of Australia, and they had some kind of, you know, web things that you could get on the internet and post a Stein Song of the Week or something, they'd had these partnership arrangements with European companies and other companies. And then I did it. I can't remember where this was now. But I spent 40 minutes trying to, and I just kept getting the runaround from T-Mobile when I was needed to get hold of them somewhere in, somewhere in northern Sweden, in Östersund or somewhere like that. And I gave up on them as just total. So it's a rotten company from my point of view. And I'd rather be able to watch Tucker Carlson without them. The thing to bear in mind is that most of the people who've abandoned Tucker have bought ad. They simply shift their ads to elsewhere on Fox so that everyone thinks, oh, T-Mobile is pulled out of Fox or whatever. No, the company just basically moves its ads to the show before Tucker or the show after Tucker. And so it can play to the woke crowd and say, yeah, I'm media. I don't want anything to do with that hideous racist. And in fact, they've just moved their ad to 7:58 p.m. into Martha's show when everybody tunes in to get ready for Tucker. And the problem is that since the big Fox boycott, which is a thing, I mean, clearly a huge number of people, a very significant number of people, basically decided after the Wednesday morning, November 4th, that they felt differently towards Fox than they had for the previous few years. And so if you've looked at the numbers in recent weeks, the big fall-off has been in Fox's respectable lineup, as it were. The shows that these awful, ghastly, woke capitalists transfer their ads to when they pull out a Tucker. And now Fox in the daytime, frequently a lot of their shows, like Outnumbered, for example, come third. Basically, the way it's been going in recent weeks is CNN wins the daytime, MSNBC wins the evening, the prime time. And there are two tent poles. The Five wins comes number one at 5 p.m. Eastern, and Tucker comes number one at 8 p.m. Eastern. And I was a little nervous about this because of all the roiling and indeed the barrage of criticism that Fox has had, and I was thrilled nevertheless to come number one, to maintain the tent pole, as it were, and come number one on the nights I guest hosted a week or so back, because a guest host is just there to hold the audience. So a guest host who drives away the audience is just someone that nobody's used to. But there's something going on. You know, there's something going on that they what happened. People weren't happy about election night, and people have not been happy about post-election night. Margie CT, which possibly means she's from Connecticut, says, Mark, what are your plans for Christmas? Lockdown, unlocked? And specifically, what are the plans for your Christmas show, if we can get a few hints? The last one was just delightful. I was sorry not to be able to make it into Montreal, but I'm very much looking forward to your holiday production in whatever form you are able to produce. Well, you know, people say, oh, I'm not cancelling Christmas. I'm not. What I love about Christmas, as you know, I love to do Christmas shows. And Christmas shows involve having a band, involves having singers, involves having actors and other performers, involves having a live audience. And none of that can be done. The place we do it in Montreal is one of my favourite spaces, has been for much of my life. And it's got nothing really to do with Montreal. We couldn't do it in New Hampshire. We couldn't do it in London. We couldn't do it in Paris. We couldn't do it in Hawaii. It's actually to do what we did last year, which I did with nary a thought. And it was all a bit, it's an intimate venue, which is why I like it, because it looks great on TV. But when you're actually there in person, the stage is just a tad smaller than you'd like, and the band was just a bit larger than actually fits on that stage, and there's not enough dressing rooms and all the rest of it, so people are all a bit too close together, and all that, and none of that can be people are having dinner and drinking, and none of that can be done. And the question is, Van Morrison, as you know, Sir Van Morrison, on the other side of the ocean, has made these. He's furious because he thinks this is the death of live music forever. And if you look at the music business now, nobody makes any money from gramophone records anymore. It doesn't do you any good having a big number one album, whatever that is, in the age of digital downloads. You make very little money from it. And the way these groups keep going is because they're out on the road all the time and they sell a few CDs at intermission and after the show. And that's how they keep going. Almost all your classic rock guys, that's what's holding them up. Also the same for a lot of other fellas, stand-up comedians. A lot of the people you see on the Fox News All-Stars panel, you know, your Jonah Goldbergs and co. Jonah's out on the road 300 nights a week appearing in this or that college town. And that's all gone. That's all gone. And so Christmas, I don't know what we're going to do for Christmas. We have some Christmas tales for our time, and we shall have some other Christmas entertainments for you. But that Mark Stein Christmas show, Margie, that you enjoyed last year, hold on to that. I hope it's not the last, but it's, you know, it's just, I think I spoke about this before. I'm just, you know, I miss life. You know, I understand I'm weird and that I do not, and that there will, I understand I'm very different from my New Hampshire neighbors. And so, for example, the closed border, the fact that I'm unable just to drive over the border and have lunch with friends is dismal to me. I looked into Kevin Amos, who was our musical director on that Christmas show last year. We've got some unfinished stuff we wanted to do, and we looked into, I can't remember whether I mentioned this before, but the studio we've used for decades in London has closed, so we asked our engineer, and we looked at, we're looking at Air Lyndhurst, which is George Martin's place. After he wearied of Abbey Road at one point, he built his own studio, and that's Air Lyndhurst. And we looked at one other one, and we're getting all these questions about, so we're having to cut musicians. These are studios you could have fit a symphony orchestra in until the COVID hit. And now you've got to have 10 people. If you can get 10 musicians in there, maybe they've all got to be standing in opposite corners, especially if you've got anything that involves an embouchure. So if you've got a trumpeter or a trombonist or a saxophonist or a clarinetist, they've got to be, you've got to have a football field between them in case any expectorant flies across the room during the wild trombone solo and settles on the end of the bass clarinetist's nose. And there's no way, and it's all over. Van Morrison is right, God bless him. It's all dead, and it's never going to come back. Doc Fauci says, you know, the great showman Fauci, because Fauci's press conferences and Fauci's telly interviews are the only entertainment left, says Broadway, he's reasonably confident that Broadway might be able to reopen in the fall of 2021. I mean, that's if you own a theatre, you're carrying that theatre. A guy who owns the theatre that he hasn't got, he owned the theatre that had Hamilton in it, whoever that is, the Schuberts or the Niederlanders. Now he's got nothing. He's got nothing going on in there, and he can't put anything on in there. And so he's just like a supersized version of the guy with a diner that seats 30 people who's told he can only have 70 people on it. We're killing everything. We're killing everything. And it's getting more and more arbitrary. The lockdown initially was just a total lockdown for 2 weeks. It's okay, everything's on hold for a couple of weeks. Great, I can understand that. And then the couple of weeks turned into 4, 5, 6 months or whatever it is. And now we have this thing where, oh, you're a little bit out of lockdown, but not quite, because now we're going to put you back. But this time we're going to have a bunch of entirely different rules from the last lockdown that there's no science behind. They're completely arbitrary. We now requiring you to wear masks in your house and have no one from your... if this is the new normal, we have to say no to it, because you can't. I mean, it's child abuse for children, making children wear masks, children cooped up, unable to go anywhere, children being even more moronic than the current generation are. The next generation, we're basically going to be devolving back to the Stone Age, because people are just like crawling around, kids are crawling around in a tiny little space for a year. Chris Dre says, hi, Mark, happy to be listening to the Q&A live for a change. Conservative media reported yesterday the Department of Justice sues Facebook for discrimination against Americans in favor of H-1B visa workers. The same conservatives, including Tucker, also reported that, quote, the conservative lion of the Senate, Mike Lee, led the charge in the Senate to remove all caps from H-1B visas. This was the thing I mentioned on the Mark Steyn show, passed by unanimous consent in the Senate. Mark, do you think victories in Georgia are anything more than a butterfly bandage on a blown artery? And if Donald Trump manages to not ruin himself with the election challenges and his seeming inability to find or manage proper personnel and resources, how does this new populism take flight, with or without Trump? Just asking for a friend who is still nursing his Tea Party wounds. Chris, I know how you feel. Mike Lee is one of those, the rock-ribbed, you know, Utah, rock-ribbed conservative Mike Lee, Utah senator. He's not like that other Utah senator, Mitt Romney. Unfortunately, Google, YouTube, I think it was, moved into Utah, and ever since then, Mike Lee has been a complete wimp on this stuff. So basically, Mike Lee is the senator for Google, and Google want all these H-1B. Basically, they'd just rather India staffed everywhere in the Google operation. And I'm not particularly, I love Indians, and I'm always very happy to get Rajiv or Suresh on the line when I need customer support. They can actually do that from Bangalore, though. They don't actually need to be imported into America and to remove this cap on this thing. This is a disaster. And the fact that everybody voted for it, including Ted Cruz and whoever else you want to name, is not good. And I will say one other thing too. 2:30 is just the start of what should be gone. There's no real point talking about this now because the Republicans have, as usual, have left it too late. And these guys are bigger than most countries now, which is the problem. These woke billionaires. As you know, I think of 2:30 just as a start. They should not, this legal immunity that certain chat rooms basically were given in the mid-1990s is nothing to do with these abusive monopolies in their different spheres, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, Google. So whether you do audio, whether you do video, whether you do short bits, whether you do long form, there's one of each, and they all coordinate, and they run the planet. And Section 230 is the first thing that ought to go, but I'm in favor of using antitrust to break them up. But the problem is, you think to yourself, where are the conservative think tanks on that? All these people, Facebook, Google, have all given money to the Washington think tanks, which is why the Washington think tanks, the so-called conservative think tanks, the so-called libertarian think tanks, have not a word to say on any of this stuff. Because whether or not Mike Lee is just a racket as a senator, and it's a slightly different thing when you actually run for elected office, one assumes you are hoping, at least initially when you go into it, to do something with your office. You know, it's nice to be a senator. It's nice to have 65 staffers feeding you lines to read out at Senate hearings. But one assumes that underneath all that, you still wish to accomplish something during your years in office. It's different with these think tanks. These think tanks are basically, if you look at it now, these think tanks have had great difficulty raising money the last year. They can't hold the gala banquets and fly in Jonah Goldberg to give a speech and make a big bunch of money and all the rest of it. So the fact that they're getting money, the money they're getting from Google and Facebook is actually more important to them. And they're not going to get that money if they call for antitrust legislation to be applied to Facebook or Google. So that's an important thing. Richard Mallaby says, "Hi, Mark, love the club. 'Tis the season for thanks and reflection. I was a senior at St. Anselm College, that's in southern New Hampshire, back in '07-'08, and reading America Alone became the catalyst for my senior thesis, not in small part because it made me stop and think, how come they don't teach this sort of thing? Thank you, Richard." That's why I wrote it, actually. You know, that's how I feel about having to follow stupid in-party election campaign. Oh, look, Kamala Harris is down 2 points against Marianne Williamson in Ohio. I mean, that's how I feel about that, because we're not teaching anything important. We're not talking about anything important. And you say, "A few years later, my wife and I saw you at the Dana Center, and I can't recall if it was just before or after America was released." Yeah, I remember that, actually. That was a fun night. I think it was just after, or it may even have been the week after America was released. And it was... I'll tell you something about this. I wanted to have Michelle Bachmann come on and do the warm-up for me, because she was then running for president. And one of her staffers thought that being associated with me, Michelle tells this in a very funny way. Not her staffers, her campaign, you know, consultant or whatever. Didn't even bring up the invitation to her because they thought, whoa, we don't want her going anywhere near that. Because Michelle was talking about my book everywhere she went on the stump then. But what an excellent presentation, says Richard, simultaneously sobering and hysterical. Now you're the first choice fill-in for both the number one TV opinion show and the guy who almost single-handedly invented talk radio. I think I was doing that back then. I was guest hosting for Rush on radio and Sean on TV back then. I couldn't imagine the burden of your headaches, what with the Canadian Islamic Congress, Carrie Katz, Michael Mann, and I'm sure others. But I'm thankful that you're out there fighting the free speech bullies for the rest of us. I think that's where it actually helps sometimes to have an international perspective, Richard. I thank you for that kindness. But I know, for example, you know, when I look at the courage of some of those Danish cartoonists I met who have been in an awful situation over 15 years and yet have still kept their spirits up and still never regretted their bravery, their courage. And it's interesting to me sometimes you can go to some little nothing country on the fringe that nobody thinks about. And even within that nation, a sort of slightly obscure corner of it, and not something people in that country necessarily think about. And you can find huge reserves of inspirational courage, little pinpricks on the map. And I think about that. I look at sometimes the biggest towns, the biggest players, Washington or London or Brussels, or Paris, are the places where you find where to go back to risk aversion, as we were talking about earlier. It's also, in a way, courage aversion. The instinct is always just to boot something. It's everything is like the debt now racing toward 30 trillion. We need decide nothing. Let's just kick it down the road. Kick it down the road. And sometimes, if you want to find people taking a stand, you do have to go to little places as the big players see it, like Denmark. And I'm grateful for that. And it's one of the things that keeps me optimistic, actually. And I know things are difficult everywhere. But again, what happens, I know from my own experience, that it's never about numbers. You know, it's never about, and every conservative knows that. We need more conservatives. We need more conservatives. But we also need, in a certain sense, to learn the lessons of the left. There's no majority for forcing 8-year-olds, the parents of 8-year-olds, to let their kid transition. There's no majority for that at all. What there is the absence of opposition to it. And if the opposition, again, because it's like, don't go near, it's not something, why don't you talk about a corporate tax cut instead? The left are abolishing the sexes, and we can't muster the challenge to oppose that, you know? And again, it's all that risk averse, the over-entourage tosspots of the US Senate, you know, the ones who voted unanimously. Why, if you're a pal of Ted Cruz, ask Ted Cruz why he went along with that. Owen Morgan writes, in England and Wales today, you can get a quasi-criminal record for a non-criminal hate incident, for expressing or even implying scepticism about transgender politics or whatever. Even though this is explicitly not a crime, there is a crime report so described, an offence and a suspect. Hate amounts to antagonism, unfriendliness, or dislike. Police officers, I'm not joking, investigate such supposed non-crime crimes in schools following anonymous tip-offs on a website and name and record pupils as suspects even though no crime has been committed. You can get an indelible non-criminal criminal record at the age of 14 just for doubting the current orthodoxy. It's over 31 years since the Berlin Wall came down, but is the Stasi now reborn in the West? Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And it's been a long time a-coming, but in the last decade, It's really accelerated. The investigation, basically... Oh, okay. Hey, I'm sorry about that, but that's the point at which the bit of wet string that connects us to the planet snapped, and we were left bereft and unable to continue. I don't know why that's happening, but I notice that whenever you complain about the sinister, all-powerful hand of big tech, and you combine it with the surveillance of the overzealous constabularies, such as Her Majesty's in England and Wales, that things like this tend to happen more frequently than they used to. So I'm sorry we weren't able to continue live, but I thank you for dialing us up around the world. And I'll be here over the weekend with our continuing serialization of our current tale for our time, P.G. Wodehouse, Smith journalist. Smith didn't have these problems in the years before the Great War in Manhattan, as we do now. We'll be continuing that tale for our time. Kathy Shadle will be here for the Saturday movie beat, and we'll have music and a few other bits and pieces. And I hope you'll want to tune us up or in or down for that. But for the moment, this is me bleating into the ether as we wonder what has happened to our connection to the world. Did the Chinese pull off an EMP attack? Did the Mullers nuke us? I hardly dare to tiptoe out of the studio door and survey the wasteland from the window. But we will see you next time, hopefully on our Clubland Q&A.